Good morning. I used it too soon. My name is Tarek Madkour. I'm a lead program manager for the Visual C++ team. I run the compiler and libraries group. And I basically, what I'm going to be talking to you about today is the great new things that we've added in Visual Studio 2010 for C++ developers in the language space. So how have we improved the language, and what is new, and how can you make use of it to write great modern applications that utilize the full of C++? One of the very interesting things about this year in specific is that there is a new standard in C++ coming out. How many of you are aware of the C++ ZeroX standard? About a third. So we have, C++, it's been in standards for over 20 years now. And for the past, since 2003, there have been no updates to the standard. And the major update to the standard that's happened before that was 1998. And for a while, we've been working on this new standard after 2003. And first we called it, C++ 05 for 2005. And then we said 06, then 07. And it started taking a little bit longer. So somebody said, let's call it 08, and they said, let's just call it 0x instead, in case it tries to go to 2009, but we expect that it's going to be done by then. And of course, it's 2010 already, and, things in standards take a while. So so some people say, 0x doesn't work anymore. It's going to have to be one something. But, of course, the C++ geeks still say, no, it can be hexadecimal, it'll be 0xb. So we're going to have the C++ 0xb standard. And it's coming out, so last week was a major milestone in the standard. We had what we call the final committee draft. And final committee draft basically means there are no new features coming into the standard. All the discussions now are around wording the things that we have agreed on. So we know exactly what features are coming in the standard, and we have decided what is going to go there for the international C++, the ISO C++ standard that is implemented by all the compilers. And that probably means that we're going to be done with a final version that is ratified as a standard next year. The reason I lead with this story is now that we're going to have a new standard, traditionally in Visual C++, because we're the biggest compiler on the Windows platform, we try not to implement features unless they have been voted into a standard, because while the standard is still in progress, the syntax changes, for example. And if we ship a compiler with versions that are not complete yet in the standard, when the standard changes, before it becomes ratified, it means that we continue to have to support both versions. The one that we shipped, which was modified after that when the standard ships, and then the final standard version, which is a bad thing for us to support two things, and a bad thing for you asking you to change your code after that, right? So we try to not support anything in a standard until the standard is fully finalized. Now, we made an exception. I don't know how I'm pressing all of these. Wow, I didn't know it was traveling. Let's get back here. So we made an exception for this time around. I'll put it here just in case I do something silly with it. So we made an exception this time around for C++ 0x. And the reason for that was there were so many good things in the C++ 0x standard that enable us to give you better libraries and enable you to write better code that we thought we'd make an exception for this time. And so even though the standard has not been coded yet and there is no C++ 0x standard that is final, we actually have features in the Visual C++ 2010 that we are shipping in 12 days that do support C++ 0x. Yes, we have a question?
Are they fully compliant with the standard that's been agreed on?
Yes, so the question is, are these features you implemented fully compliant with the standard that has been agreed on? Yes, they are compliant with the current final committee draft. We do not expect that these features will change. We specifically picked the features that are the highest value, and we know enough about them that we think they're not in a change that they're going to change. Now, I'll never say never. I don't know what is going to happen over the next year, but we really do not expect any of the features that we implement to change. At least we hope so. Yeah, and feel free to just raise your hand and wave it, because I can barely see everyone. and I'll be happy to stop and answer your question during the talk. So we chose 6 features in the language to implement. And we have, you know, at the end of the slide, I can show you the full table of C++ ZeroX features and which ones we decided to implement ahead of the time. And, of course, we're going to be adding new features in the next releases as the standard actually becomes ratified. So the 6 features that we selected are the ones that you see up here. And, you know, the first 2, auto and decal type, are sort of related together, so I grouped them together. So we really have 5 buckets of features. And I'll talk about each one in specific over the rest of this talk. And at the end, I'll mention a little bit about some of the library features that are also part of the standard and tell you why they are important for you. So let's start with the first. Auto and decal type. The reason I group them together is that because both of them are about what we call type inference. So think about the compiler knowing about the types that you are writing, which it has always known, but also giving you the ability to use that in your code, the type of something, right? So think about this code. This is code that you normally write now. You have a pointer to a certain type, const foo pointer. And it equals new foo, right? And you normally need that. You're saying foo in both places, and this works, right? And how many use STL? Half. Half of you use STL. STL is a very famous or infamous for using very verbose types. So you can have a vector of a map of a string and a string, and then writing that becomes very long. So you typically would do something like this, you know, for map of string, string, and then you get the iterator of that, and then you continue, right? Auto keyword allows you to do something like this. It basically tells the compiler, go figure out, understand for me what that type is, and use it. Please don't let me write all of this. Save me some time, right? So you can use it for the normal cases in initialization, for example, and automatically the compiler is going to figure out, oh, new foo returns a foo pointer. So p is going to become a foo pointer. Or you can say, you know, auto I equals m.begin, and I here, oh, m.begin returns an iterator, and it's an iterator to that specific STL type. So we automatically know what type I is. You don't have to write it yourself. Why is this good? It's good for multiple reasons. The first reason is it is more brief. And this is good because it makes you write less code. It's easier for you to write. It requires less thinking on your part, and it will be still as good. And the second reason is those people who are reading code after you, how many of you work on code that you write versus code that somebody else wrote? How many work on code that somebody else wrote? Almost all of you, okay? We all work on code that, you know, somebody else has written, and it really helps us when that person has taken the time to, like, add comments and to write code in a structured and a nice way. So auto helps with that, right? It helps with if you have a loop and, you know, you know that this is going to be an iterator and you just saw, you know, you've been using this before. You don't need to see all these complications. Something easier would be nice. The second thing is being able to write generic functions or generic pieces of code that you can then, you know, copy and paste and reuse somewhere else. So for example, in the for loop right here, hey, it's working. In this for loop, you're able to go and say, you know, if you wanted to cut this line and paste it and use it anywhere, you could, right? You don't have to go change anything. It will work with any type of iterator that you have. So it helps you write generic code. The one thing that I love about auto is that we've always had this ability in the compiler, right? The compiler, if you think about templates, when you had a template class and you know, it was specialized in 2 ways, or even if it was 1 specialization, and then you tried to instantiate that template, the compiler had to deduce the type in order to know which template to bind to, which template to instantiate. And we just never exposed this to you in the compiler. So now we're just adding that ability to expose it to you using the auto keyword. The nice thing about auto as well, you will notice in my first example, I had written const foo pointer. But then when I did auto, auto will probably just return a foo pointer. Or if it was, you know, then you can go and actually say, I want it to be const. So you can say const auto pointer. And that is going to return whatever type foo returns, but it's going to automatically deduce it. So you can add CV qualifiers to it as well. You can add constants, you can specify if it's a pointer or references, you can specify volatile attributes, you can specify anything you want on top of auto to do further specifics if you want that. The other thing is that becomes useful is for auto, if you're going to have types that you don't know the name of. Sometimes the compiler automatically generates types, and we're going to come to this when you talk about another features, which is lambdas later on. Some compiler types are not exposed. They don't actually have a name. And you can just use auto to capture those. And I'll show an example of this later on in the slides. One thing to be very clear on, though, is that auto does not do anything dynamic, right? Auto is just what we call syntactic sugar. Syntactic sugar means it doesn't enable anything new that you couldn't do before. It just makes the syntax look nicer, look a little bit different. So when you say auto, you know, auto P or auto I equals, it doesn't mean that I can be anything, and then later on, you know, you can say auto I equals 10, it'll make I an int, and then after that assign I a string, and that will work. It's not like VB, for example, where you can, or any of the dynamic languages where you could do that. C++ continues to be strongly typed, so if you have an auto I equals 10, I will always be an int. And if you try to assign something else to it after that, it will fail, right? So it continues to be strongly typed. Auto has the effect only on the current statement that you're doing, and after that, auto is gone, right? One thing to note is that auto can break existing code because auto is an already existing keyword in language. Today, if you go in the IDE and you type auto, you'll see it colored blue. And the reason for that is there, you know, you could say auto int i equals 10, and auto was basically treated as a volatile, right? And it was a redundant keyword. Nobody needed it. Nobody used it. One of the things that we do when we introduce a breaking change in Microsoft is we go and compile all of Windows. We go and compile all of Office. We go and compile all of SQL. All the source bases, the really big source bases that we have, and we try to see how often are we breaking people, right? How much breaks? And for something like auto, we find that very, very few things actually break because people have traditionally not been using this because it's a redundant keyword. So we don't think it's going to be a big impact on anyone. But if there is, it's actually a very simple thing to do. If you have an auto already, just go remove it. Everything will work just the way it worked before. Now, the second feature is decal type, and I call this the sister feature to auto. And decal type allows you to get the type of an expression, right? So consider, you know, who knows what the result of adding an int to an int is? What is the type of that going to be? Adding an int to an int. An int, that's right. What about adding an int to a float? Float. What about adding a float to an int? Float, that's right. So the result of adding a type, you know, two types together may be one of these types. It may be the same if they were the same, or maybe if you had, you know, a different operator, it could return something else. We don't know exactly what it does. So if you wanted to create a generic function, for example, that said, add anything to anything and return whatever the result is, you're never able to do that in C++. You cannot go and say, template type name T, and you'll see this example here. Template type name T, type name U, plus of T and U. You can't put T here in the return value. You cannot put U. You don't know what the return type is beforehand. So you're never able to write a generic function that can add two things together, whatever the things are. But with decal type, and this is where decal type is actually more useful than auto because it actually enables new scenarios that were never possible before, you can actually go and say, you know what? This is the syntax for decal type. You know, this is the return type of this function. It's going to be automatically deduced, and you can calculate it by getting the compile time knowledge of what is T plus U. So compiler, go figure out, if I added a T and a U, what would it be? Use that as the return type of this when you're instantiating the template. So if I'm using it later and I'm saying plus of 10 and 11, the compiler is going to say, oh, int, the result is int. If I say the plus of 10 and 3.2, is going to say int, float. The result is going to be a float, right? So the generic function now works. So this is a new feature. It's very, very useful. You can also use it to do something like this, right? You would never want to do this because this is exactly the same as auto. This is what auto does. Y equals new foo. Oh, that returns a foo pointer. Basically, decal type of new foo evaluates to foo pointer. So auto is actually implemented this way. Auto does this behind the scenes. The reason I put this example up there is to clarify that this expression here never gets executed. There is only one foo being newed in this statement. And it is the foo, the new foo, after the equal sign. The one between the decal type state in the keyword, this never gets executed. This is just for the compiler to evaluate that expression and never execute it, right? This only is looked at compile time. After the compiler generates code, this translates to foo pointer y equals new foo. Now, the next feature I want to talk about is static asserts. Asserts are very, very valuable things in the language. So traditionally, you do an assert for runtime, right? So if you have a certain function, and in the function you expected a value that is always less than 100, and you get something that is more than 100, you do an assert that this value is always less than 100, and you display an error at debug time, right? So you have a debug assert, which is very handy and useful. Then later on, as we started to write more generic code, code that has more templates, we thought, wouldn't it be a great idea if we're able to verify the types of these templates passed? For example, in your template, you call a member function you access a member variable of the type that is being passed to you in the template, and you want to make sure that this member function exists or that this this type that is being passed is of something that you expect. You don't expect anything to be passed, right? You want to give an error if it is not of a certain class. For example, I only want to be specialized with instant floats, but everything else just fail on. Otherwise, I'll be really surprised if I saw a string. If you see a string, just please give an error at the compile time. Otherwise, it's not. So what happens if you didn't do that, right? So static assertions basically is the ability to do this static checking at compile time and give an error. We've always had pound error, right? You could always do, if not defined something, pound error, and here's a string to write. And then whenever the compiler is going through that line, it will just issue an error. You could only do it based on conditionals that are preprocessor conditionals, macro conditionals, right? But now this extends it to actual compiler conditionals. You can now do a conditional based on a type, for example, or the size of a type, or the position of something in a type, right? People have worked around this inability of C++ to do compile time checks, compile time asserts, by using extensions like Boost. Anybody uses Boost? A few of you use Boost, okay. So Boost had this, they had a Boost static assert that was able to do this. But static assert in the language builds on top of what Boost has and provides something better. So consider this example, right? If you had a class and that class takes a type, and you're saying, I'm expecting an unsigned int, right? You didn't specify it anywhere, but that's your expectation inside the class that you're going to have an unsigned int. And if in your, somewhere in your code, you instantiate it with a signed int, nobody's going to complain. It's going to work. Maybe you're going to get a warning, but typically you're not. So what happens is you get a runtime failure. If you never check on this, what happens is, it could be a failure, that not at a crash, but it could be now you passed it minus 10 and all of a sudden you're getting a really large number and your class is acting weird, right? You get bugs. So if you add a static assertion, for example, with Boost, then you can go and say, if it is, check with a type trait, make sure that it is unsigned. And if it's not, give an assert. So you get an error that looks like this at compile time. As you build this, if you try to instantiate with a signed int, you get something that says Boost static assertion failure with x equals false, unsigned int equals int, see the reference of this template, blah, blah, blah. If you're experienced with Boost, you could understand what that means. It's kind of, a bit of gibberish, but you could understand it, right? So static asserts is very similar. It's nicer syntax. It's cleaner syntax. And it allows you to to basically also type the same, you know, type an actual string that is going to be shown in the error message for the compiler. So if you try to compile this and instantiate this class that expects an unsigned int with a signed int, you're going to get exactly this. Error, my class requires an unsigned int. The error message that you wrote. Right? So it becomes very, very useful and very pointed at the thing that you want to tell the user of your class, right? So it becomes a very much better error message than what we had before. There are many values, you know, many places where you can use static asserts. Types obviously is the biggest part, you know, the type checking of something. Another part is comparing enums or enum values, right? Sometimes you make assumptions in your code about, you know, if a certain enum had A and B and C members in it, that A is always less in value than B because you use that somewhere in a comparison statement or something like that. And then when somebody goes and changes the order of B and A in the declaration of your enum, your code breaks. So you can actually verify that with static asserts. You can go say, you know, verify that the value of, you know, enum colon colon A is less than the value of enum colon colon, colon B. And otherwise just fail on that. And this is also possible. Another thing where this becomes very valuable is, and there is a whole laundry list of, you know, places where this becomes valuable and you can read it. But another place, and it's a common mistake, is bit fields. The nice thing with bit fields is that we are used to, if you have a bit field, and let's say, you know, as a, you know, 32-bit field, that you could go and add, keep adding to them, right? You can, it would have 20 of them already, and you can add number 21, and the size of the struct does not change, because a 21-bit bit field is the same as a 20-bit bit field in size, right? What then happens after you add, you know, we go from number 31 to number 32, and then the bit number 33 is, we allocate a whole new byte or a whole new word or a D word, depending, and that becomes, that increases the size of your bit field by 816 or 32 bits. So now if you had anything that makes assumptions on the size of that struct, which a lot of code does, you will fail. And it will be a silent failure. Nobody will know how that happened, and you'll only notice it weeks later after debugging a really, really bad crash somewhere. So future-proofing your code says you understand these assumptions that you're making in your own code, and you try to code them with the code that you're writing. So you have an assumption that the size of this class is always going to be 64 bits or 25 bytes or whatever it is, then you can check that. And you can static assert if that is not the case. You can just give a compile time error. So the value of this would be this person who goes and adds that extra bit in your bit field, the minute they go add it, the next compile they're going to do, they're going to get a compiler error. And the compiler error is probably going to say something like whatever statement that you put there. I expect this struct to be this number of bits. Oh, I had just changed that struct. Thank you. Right? So now you avoided that whole problem of finding that error or trying to diagnose it and going. You just help the next person who's going to be using your code. And that person could be you. Somebody else, if they do that to you, your life will be better, right? The next feature I want to talk about, and this perhaps one of my favorite features in this release, is lambdas, lambda expressions. Lambda expressions are basically a way to do function objects. Traditionally in C++, or in coding in general, you want to be able to pass code around, right? You want to be able to go and say, I have this operation, and to work on it, use this function, right? And you pass a function pointer. C and C++ have the concept of function pointers. You can pass a function pointer around, and you can do the actions on the code that you want. Now, function pointers allow you to pass code around. Now, what if this code needed some state? It needed to be stateful between every call. Then you create a function object, or a functor. And you can create function objects and pass the function objects around. And that also works. A problem with function objects is twofold. One of them is, well, first of all, they're a bit complicated to write. Second, they are non-local. So in the place that you're calling that function, you have to get out of your way, see where that function object is declared, and use it. This is good if this function object is used everywhere. Like, for example, if you have a sort function and you're going to use it in 100 places around your code, that's a good thing. You want the sort to be in one place, and you want all the different 100 places to call that one place. That makes sense. But often enough, we're just using an API, and that API requires a function pointer. So you just have to get out of your way, create a function somewhere or a functor somewhere, and pass it to that API. And you're not using it anywhere else. You're just using it in that place or in these two places. So you're actually going out of the normal code flow to create this. So the problem of non-locality is actually important, right? And some people have worked around that also with library solutions, but then the syntax becomes extremely ugly, very, very complicated. So lambdas were created to solve this problem, right? So this is typical code that you would write. If you wanted to iterate over all the members of a certain vector to print them, you would go and create this print functor, which overloads operator parentheses, and it gets called on every member of the vector, every element in the vector, and it writes it. Very simple. You could have done this with a function pointer as well if you wanted to. But again, you see the problem, right? Imagine this actually being a very large source file, and this being in the end of the source file, and this being in the beginning of a source file, and a different source file. Just to see what this does, you have to go fetch what print functor actually does. Lambdas allow you to write this in a much cleaner way, just like this. Right? So in your code, you're specifying a function. And this is the syntax for a lambda, right? In your code, you're specifying a function, and you're telling it what this function actually does. You're saying that, compiler, go ahead, create a new function for me. I don't care what you call it. Call it something. Put it somewhere else. It will take a parameter that is an int, and when you call it, this is the kind of code that you're going to execute. So anybody who's actually reading this code can go and see what it does. If you ever wanted to launch a thread, you know, create a thread, and the thread did something really specific, and you know, it was like five lines of code, and you were done, and you only wanted to create this thread from that one place, and you're done. Well, this becomes a very convenient way to do it. In fact, one of the new things that we added in Visual C++ in 2010 is what we call the Parallel Patterns Library. And in the Parallel Patterns Library, we give you the capability of doing writing parallel code, writing concurrent code in a simpler way. So we raise the level of abstraction from just working with low operating system things like mutexes and threads and locks to higher level constructs like tasks. And I don't have time to go into the Parallel Patterns Library. It's not the subject of this talk, but we'll be available later on in the day at the booth, and just feel free if you're interested in this. I'd be happy to talk to you about it at length in more detail. We added a lot of things for parallelism and concurrency in this release for C++. And that's one place where lambdas become very useful. For example, if you just wanted to create a background task, the background task takes a pointer to some code. Give me something, a functor, a function, something. You can just create a lambda and say, this is what I want you to do. Send this packet in the background. Done. By default, this is the full syntax of a lambda. You know, this is the grammar for the lambda as the compiler expects it. You start with what we call a capture clause. By definition, the lambda that you have inside a scope uses nothing of that scope. If you had any local functions, local members, any of that, we don't know about them. The lambda doesn't use them for performance reasons, obviously, and also for better encapsulation of code. So if you wanted to use some of the local members of a function, you just need to put them in that capture clause here. If you had, let me go back in the example. Like if I had here, a variable x, and I wanted to use x here and my cout as well, then you would need to come here in the capture clause and say, I'm also using x. You need to type x, right? By definition, if you try to use x here without using in the capture clause, the compiler will fail. You also specify the parameter list. If somebody's calling you with parameters, you specify the parameters list, and this is just like other functions. Lambdas can also have return types, right? So you can actually execute a function, get a return type from it, if your caller actually expected a return. By default, we assume that the return is a void. If you don't specify anything, every lambda returns a void. If you don't specify anything in capture, you are not capturing anything. If you don't specify anything in parameters, so this is like the minimum lambda that you can write. No capture, no parameters, returns a void. It's got a little bit of code in it. And that works. And this is, for example, of something where we're capturing code, right? Here you want to add a sum of all the elements in a vector. And what you're going to do is you have a variable, local variable total. And you want to be able to add to this total inside your lambda function. So you're capturing total here. And there are two ways to capture. You can capture by reference, or you can capture by value. When you're capturing by reference, you're telling the compiler, I'm going to change this. I'm going to be changing it. If you're capturing by value, you're asking the compiler, please go ahead and make a copy. And after you make a copy, I will be changing this copy, or I will not be changing this copy. It doesn't matter, but the original will never change. The typical by value, by reference that we have in C++, and we've always had in C++. If you wanted to pass it by reference, you have the ampersand. If you wanted to pass something by value, you put equal, right? So you could have said equal total, and then total will always be zero here, right? So it would be the wrong thing to do here. But sometimes you want to add things by copy. And a good example of when you want to take things by copy, for example, is if you had an auto pointer, right? Or a shared pointer, where if you copy it, you're going to increment the count. You're going to add a reference. But if you take it by reference, you're not going to increment the reference. So if you basically you're passing it to a function and you're creating a new copy of it, now if you exit that local scope, it continues to have a copy. And this is where I say, you know, beware of variable lifetimes. Lambdas make it easier for you. It doesn't allow you to be careless still. You still need to be very careful about the lifetimes of the things that you've passed in the lambda. You know, if this lambda was going to execute, for example, past the scope of sum, total is going to go away. So you need to be careful to make sure that total stays there. One of the things for lambdas as well is you can tell the compiler, just capture everything for me. I don't want to keep specifying the 17 local variables that I'm going to use out of this. Capture everything. Capture everything by reference, or capture everything by value. Or capture everything by reference, comma, this specific thing by value. You can specify that, right? And this becomes a very convenient thing. So often enough, you're going to see lambdas that look like this. Just ampersand. Capture everything. And that doesn't mean that the compiler is going to go and, you know, if you had, you know, 100 local variables, copy them all and create a function that takes 100 local variables. No, the compiler is smart. It will figure out, oh, you're only using total, so that means you want to capture total by reference. So these two, in that example, would be exactly the same. They would do exactly the same thing. One is just more convenient to write. But the other one is more explicit. It avoids future problems. For return types, I mentioned that by default, will return a void, right? But you could change that. You can go and declare what type of return you want, right? So in the simple case, you don't even have to tell us. So this is a simple case. There's only a return statement, or there's only one return statement. We know exactly the type of this thing. Most of the time, we can actually infer it, right? So yeah, you're returning n modulo 2, and we know that n is an int, so you're returning an int. Okay, we know that. So the compiler creates this lambda, and it knows that it returns an int. But if you actually wanted it to return a bool, you could do that too. Right? You can say, here's the syntax for saying, I want it to return a bool, because I expect this function is going to take a bool. Right? Sometimes it's also hard for us to guess what the return type is. So we allow you to specify it specifically. Next feature is null pointer. A null pointer is actually a very interesting one, because forever, you know, sorry, wrong direction. C++ has always had null. Who has nulls in their code? Who's used null? Has anybody not used null? No. Okay. Everybody uses null, right? So C++ has null. So why are we going and adding yet another null? Well, actually, because the null that we had sort of worked for us, and to make it work, we had to do some really weird compiler magic to actually make it work. But then it's starting to fail in scenarios. So what scenarios is it starting to fail at? Well, first of all, think about it from a concept perspective. A null is actually a pound defined to zero. Zero in the compiler is an int. Ints do not automatically cast to pointers. If you try to cast an int to a pointer, the compiler will complain somehow. But if you try to cast zero to a pointer, the compiler never complains about that, because we do it all the time. We pass null to something that takes a pointer. So the compiler has learned to do this special magic that says if you're passing zero, it's not really an int. It could also be a pointer. You know, ignore it for now. Which was sort of okay. I mean, it worked for us for so many years. Where it started to fail was when we started to write more generic code. And generic code that says, or overloads, you know, you're saying, bind to a pointer or bind to an integer. And if it's a pointer, do this special thing. If it's an integer, do this other thing. So now the compiler is in a bind. If you're passing it null, which actually to the compiler, they never see the word null, they just see zero. If you're passing zero, is zero an integer or is zero a pointer? I don't know. Could mean either. Right now, the compiler just assumes it's an integer because, well, zero is more likely an integer than it is a pointer. Okay. But then you really are getting into a problem. So what's the solution for that? The solution is null pointer. And here's an example that actually illustrates this, I think, very, very well. If you had two overloads for the print function, one that takes an int I and one that takes an int pointer I, you will notice that, you know, if you call it with zero, you're going to call the int one. If you call it with null, you're also going to get the int one. But if you call it with null pointer, null PTR, which is the new keyword, you're going to bind to the pointer one. This is the right thing to do. You should always now be using null pointer instead of null. You should also go clean the places where, you know, you take ints that should actually be taking pointers. If you do a decal type on null pointer, it'll return what's called null pointer T, null pointer underscore T. So this is actually the type of a null pointer. This is the internal type that the compiler uses for a null pointer. A null, the decal type of a null is a decal type of a zero, which is an int, right? If you change, if you go in your code and change everywhere that you had null to a null pointer, you will probably get some failures. And the reason you will get some failures is there will be places where you're basically passing a pointer that, you know, you were binding to an integer in the case where a null pointer will actually be binding to a pointer. So in the example, if you actually had code that looks like this, if you pass null pointer, now you're going to be going through a different code path. If you had a template that takes a type and you passed it this, you'll be going through a different code path, right? So you need to find these places to fix them if you intend to use null pointer. And the best way to find them is just do a pound define null to null pointer. If you do that, if you do a pound define null to null pointer, and you compile your code and you run it, first of all, you're going to get some compiler errors about the places where statically this was a problem, but you're also going to try to see if you run it through your tests, you're going to see which areas are actually failing. So our recommendation is start using null pointer for the new code. Every new code that you write, try to use null pointer, make sure it works for that. Going and fixing all the old code is probably a task, a chore. So schedule time for it if you feel like it, but you know, if you want to keep it the same, feel for it as well. Both of them are going to continue to work for C++ regardless, no problem, right? Just in the new code, it's actually a good thing to start using null pointer because you start avoiding when, as new people write libraries that you would like to use and you start using them in your code, you'll find that you have fewer problems when you have null pointer because they have the right binding than if you had null. Did I see a hand wave somewhere? No. Okay, so R value references is one of the, you know, more complex features of the compiler that we added this round. It's probably one of the biggest as well. And in my opinion, right after lambdas, one that is going to be most impactful and most useful. To understand why we introduced R value references and what are R value references, I'll first talk about two problems that we have. And in talking about these problems, I think it will be evident what R value references and what problem it's trying to solve. Okay? So the first problem is what we call the forwarding problem. Today, if you're writing a function, okay, and that function is doing something and then forwarding that call to some other function, right? Think about the handler, and you have your handler, and then you want to call your base class's handler. You know, you have a method, you're doing it, and then you're calling the base class method. And that method took a reference. So this is the quintessential example. You have an outer that takes a T reference, And then inner, that takes a T reference. Outer basically calls inner. Let's say it does absolutely nothing, right? If you called outer with x, where x equals 5, no problem, it will compile. But if you called outer directly with 5, it will not compile, because this is a const reference, and this is not a non-const reference, right? So you cannot do this forwarder. But you could write it this way. You could do a const T reference. So now, the x will not compile, the variable will not compile, but the const will compile. Well, we're all smart people. We write C++. What do? Very easy. You just write two overloads. C++ allows you to do overloads. So you do these two overloads. You write, you know, const T reference and a const reference. The implementation is exactly the same, no problem. And now both of them compile. Where's the problem then? Well, can you start thinking about, you know, what if you had two reference parameters? What if you had three? What if you had four? What if you had five? If you look at tr1 bind, this is one of the functions that are in the standard library, it has five reference arguments. And to implement all five reference arguments, we have to write 63 overloads of bind. 63 overloads do exactly the same thing, all of them exactly the same code. The only difference is one says const reference, 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 reference. And then reference, const reference, 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 reference. And you do all combinations of reference and const reference for all the five types, and you end up with 63 overloads. Very complicated code for something that should be very, very simple. So what's the way to fix that? Well, that's where R-value references come. R-value references basically tell the compiler, I can have a reference to a value that could be const or could be variable in some cases. And the syntax for doing that is the double ampersand. Okay? You say T double ampersand T. I'll not talk about this. You know, assume it doesn't exist for now. If you really want to know why this is, read this blog post. It's another hour and a half on its own on why this is needed. But for now, basically you can just write one function and you can call it from both. And if this function had five arguments, all were references, all were R-value references, you could call it and you can still implement the function once. Right? So we actually went ahead after implementing this feature in the compiler and we rewrote tr1 bind to be with just one implementation as opposed to 63 implementations. Now the other problem, and in my opinion the more important problem, is that of copying. And this is about performance. Who writes code that they think performance is important for it? If you think performance is important for your code, raise your hand. Most of you. Okay. Who likes to improve code performance for almost free? You like free stuff? Okay. I thought so. One of the things that C++ is very fond of is creating temporary copies of things. Because it just makes our life easier. It makes the compiler's life easier. So behind the scenes, we do a lot of temporaries. And here's one great example of that. Let's say you had... I am very fond of this clicker. Let's say you had, you know, five strings and you just wanted to concatenate them. Right? Very simple statement. This is really what happens behind the scenes. You have five memory locations, each one of them pointing to its own string. And they, you know, we go through it piece by piece. First, we do the first string and the space. And we create a temporary out of that. We store that temporary on the side, and we put welcome space in it. And then we create another temporary, and we add the next string to it. And then another temporary, and we add the string to it. And we keep adding temporaries and temporaries and temporaries until we reach eight temporaries. Create eight temporary strings just to reach that final string. And then after we do that, we move it to the original destination, and we start throwing away all the temporaries that we wrote, right? So that seemingly innocent one statement resulted in eight copies, eight temporaries. And the problem in temporaries is not only that it consumes more memory, but it involves allocation. So you allocated a string, you created a new string. You copied every single bit in the old string to the new string. And then you deallocate the string when we hit the semicolon, right? And you did that eight times. for something that should be really, really simple. So it's really quadratic. So how do you actually get better performance? If there was a way to tell the compiler, you know, these temporaries that you're creating, they're all temporaries. They're going to be thrown away. So if you're going to create the second temporary, and you can actually reuse part of the first temporary, I don't care because I was going to throw it away anyway. Can you just not throw that? If you could tell the compiler that, the compiler could be more optimal, right? We do have some optimizations that, you know, don't make it as bad as I'm explaining it here. So, for example, we have, you know, return value optimizations where we try to, oh, you know, this looks like it's something that I can, that is returning a temporary and I could do it. It only kicks in very few special cases, and in most cases it will not kick in. So in most cases you're actually getting the bad behavior. While we're writing our libraries and we use things like this, in string itself and in the operator plus, we have, you know, the optimizations for small strings. So if you're copying really, really small strings, we do optimizations that sort of don't cause this problem. But again, for normal strings, you'll see the problems. And we try to create optimizations to work around this problem. They don't kick in half the time, and half the time you're just in problem. And when you write your own code, most of the time you don't do these own optimizations by yourself, right? So what R value references allow you to do then is to create what we call move semantics. It allows you to go and tell the compiler using that same syntax, hey, normally when I'm calling a plus, for example, I'm constructing a new object. And if I'm going to have a copy constructor, I could also have a different kind of copy constructor that we're going to call the move constructor. So a copy constructor takes a reference to your object, right? We're going to have a move construction that is going to take an R value reference to your object. And in that case, when you get the R value in your move constructor, you can go and say, don't allocate new things, just copy them. If you could do that, then this is what you get instead. The first temporary that gets created, we're going to create a second temporary to it, but instead of allocating new place for that second temporary, we're just going to steal. We're going to steal what's there and add stuff to it. And you continue doing that, right? So at the end, you only had one temporary that you used, which is way of an improvement over the 8 temporaries, and only one allocation, one deallocation, right? So what you do, as I said, is you create a move constructor and a move assignment operator. So basically, you go for your classes where you know that there are going to be temporaries passed to use it in this behavior a lot, and you go and add this new constructor and this new assignment operator, and you make them take the parameters of your type reference, you know, double reference, R value reference. And that way, you can actually get a way better optimization. So let me try to go through a quick demo here that shows you some of the features that I talked about. The application that I'm going to use for the demo is quite a simple application. It is a picture viewer. And the picture viewer allows you to go and get, you know, pictures from your folders or from the web. I'm going to go to my sample pictures. And we just display the pictures, right? A very, very simple application. We do some fun things with it, like, you know, cool animations and stuff like that. And actually, one of the new things that we did in Visual C++ at 2010 is add a lot of support for MFC for creating applications that look like this. You know, if you want to create a ribbon, or you want to do animation, or you want to add touch interface. So this application also responds to touch. If I had a touch machine, I would have showed you how you can, you know, go to the next picture and go to the previous picture with touch and zoom in and zoom out, all of that. And you can build that with MFC in very, very simple things. So if you want to learn more about that, you know, feel free to come and see me at the booth as well. We're going to be at the Microsoft booth. And I'll be happy to talk to you about how you can create these kinds of applications in MFC as well. But I'm going to use this application to show you some example of using the auto feature, using the null pointer feature, using R value references, using lambdas, and why this is useful. And if we have time, maybe I'll get to show you a little bit of the parallel library code just to give you a glimpse of it to tease you into coming and talking to us. Okay? So here's the application. The first thing I want to do is I'm going to, let's say I wanted to, see, I have no functions that run on these pictures. I want to do grayscale or blur, right? Let's try to do a grayscale. And the reason I'm going to try to do grayscale is every image manipulation operation probably works on matrices. It's probably one of the best ways to use it in code, to tell the to implement it in code. And matrices and operations on matrices involve a lot of copying. They involve a lot of temporaries. So if you have a matrix and you're able to tell the compiler, when you're doing these temporary stuff, do our value moves instead, then you can improve performance. I'll try to show you how to do that. So the first thing is we're going to go implement a grayscale function for this. So I'm going to go to the resource editor. This is a typical MFC application. I'm going to look at the ribbon that we have. And this is another new feature in Visual C++ in 2010, which is the ribbon designer. Let me pin my toolbox. And you can go here in the ribbon and say, I want to add a new button. You can move it around. Let's not do this. You can use the ribbon designer to move things around. If you want to confuse people and put the previous before the next, you could do that. Don't do that. I'll not do that. So I'll do this button. And let's set some properties on it. We'll call it grayscale. I'll give it a better ID than button 2. Let's call it ID grayscale. Okay. And let's give it a nice image about that. Does this look good now? Okay. So now, one of my favorite IDE features in Visual Studio 2010. How many people use Visual C++6? A few of you do. We should really talk after the session. We should chat. One of the features that we had lost after VC6 is the class wizard. So I'm happy that in Visual Studio 10 we got it back. We've been fighting to get this back for a long time, so I'm happy we finally have it here. So I'm going to go. The class wizard allows me to add handlers, for example, to methods or override virtual functions. So I'm going to go to my view here, my view class, and now when we got it back, it does search. So I can type gray, here's my ID gray, and go and say add handler. How many people use MFC? Half? Third? So if you add a handler, I'm going to call it on grayscale. Let's go edit the code. One of the best demo features in Visual Studio is the ability to just paste code from the toolbox. So this is really simple code. All it does is it gets the size of the image, then it gets the size of an image, it gets the number of pixels there, it gets all the pixels, and it calls a certain transformation function on those pixels, and that transformation function is to calculate the gray. And the way that you calculate the gray on a pixel is it has a red value, a green value, and a blue value. You take the average of all these three values and you set it to be red, green, and blue. So all the red and green and blue become the same thing. So if red and green and blue are all the same, it'll be a grayscale. It'll be a shade of gray. So you just take the average of all the red and green and blue values for a pixel, you assign it to be the same thing, and you're done, right? So we want to express that. So you go iterate over all the pixels, and you call a transform on it, right? Let me put it here. It's actually more visible. How about that? This looks better. Right, and I'm calculating the time it takes before and after this loop. The reason I'm calling it 10 times is that grayscale on a 1024x768 image takes a few hundred milliseconds, and trying to see the performance improvement in a few hundred milliseconds is hard. But typically, you're not doing grayscale for just one image; you're doing grayscale for 10 images or 100 images, and then you can start to see it more pronounced. So I'm assuming here we're doing the grayscale 10 times. and calling the function 10 times on the same pixels is still the same, you know, CPU hit. And at the end, we're just going to say how much time it took. Okay. You'll see that I'm using auto here, for example, right? I have a pdoc arrow my images get size. I'm not sure exactly what that returns. It actually returns a d to d size const. D to d size f, right? So I know automatically then if I go to s and hover over it, the compiler knows that this is a d to d size f. So this is the equivalent as if you wrote d to d underscore size space s. So, and that's where, you know, I tell you that autos, it is just effective at the line that you wrote it, right? The compiler right after this line now assumes that what you had written was not auto s, it was a d to d size instead. Autos are even more useful when it's a lambda, right? Here I'm actually creating a function. So grayscale is actually a function, right? And here you can see IntelliSense picking up on it as well and says, this is actually a function that takes a raw image colon colon pixel and it returns a raw image colon colon pixel. So I created this lambda here, right? And in this lambda, I'm going to be using it when I call the apply filter function. Apply filter is a function that goes and iterates over all the pixels and calls for each pixel that function on it. Very simple function. Now, originally I would have had to create a function outside this here or create a member function of the CPhotoViewer view and then call that, right? And it probably wouldn't be on the view itself. You would just create something else that does transformations because otherwise it really doesn't belong on a view. And you're going to create a functor and you're going to apply that to it, right? So it becomes complex. It becomes non-local, as we mentioned here. You just say, this is my function. Call it here. Alternatively, I could have done away without that auto as well and just took this code and pasted it here. Oh, by the way, you notice this now? It's finally in C++ we have red squiggles that tell you when you have errors without having to wait until you compile. Here's the error, error identifier grayscale is not there. We just removed it. So let's go here and say, do this. You could just paste the lambda here if you wanted to. Right? That also works. They're all the same. Let's just keep it at the way it is because it's cleaner. Okay? Now if we compile this and run it, let's see how much time it takes. I'm going to go get the images. They're all nice here. Let's go see the tulips. And on this image, I'm going to press grayscale. Let's see how long it takes. It took 6 seconds. Let's do it a few times just to see. And, doing a grayscale on an already gray image is not any more efficient than doing it on a color image. It's the same algorithm, it's the same bits, we're just reading different values, so it still works. 6.5 seconds. One more time just to be sure. seconds, yeah. Way faster. Sometimes the operating system decides to give all the resources to that running application now, it makes it a little faster, so let's see. So roughly, it took 6-point-something seconds, or 6.5, once it took 5.2, okay? Let's see if we can do any better than this. Most of the time, this is really where I'm measuring the time, right? So I'm getting tick count here, and then getting tick count there, right? So this is really where I'm spending all the time that I'm measuring. And there is only one thing that is happening 10 times here, which is this assignment. So there, if you look at the performance, there are two places where we consume time. One of them is the actual calculation of the grayscale, like, you know, taking the pixel, averaging it, and doing all of that. And the second thing is the copy from the temporary generated by apply filter to into that raw image. Right? There's a temporary that gets created, and it's of type raw image. And let's see what raw image is. Raw image is a graphics colon colon image colon colon raw image, so of a class type raw image. So that class, we create a temporary out of it, and we copy it. And that class happens to be a set of pixels that has a size of 1024 by 768 in this case. So it's a sizable amount. It's not huge, but it's a sizable amount. And if you do it a number of times, it's going to be, you know, a big deal. So you're spending time calculating grayscale, and you're spending time copying. If you were improving the performance of this, you would go try to make the grayscale faster. And you would also try to see if you could actually reduce the time taken copying. In fact, to a certain extent, you cannot reduce grayscale beyond, you know, beyond a certain performance characteristics. But then if you can eliminate the copying, which is an overhead, then that's better. You want to spend your time doing the real work, not the overhead. So let's see how we can improve that time. Here's a raw image. I'm going to go to definition on it. That is of type raw full image. I'm going to go to definition on that as well. And here's my raw image here, right? It just has the pixel, which has these values, has a constructor, and then a little kernel for the image. And here is the copy constructor, right? The copy constructor takes a reference. And in the reference, you can see that we're assigning the things that can be assigned, bit copying them. And then the pixel array, because it's an array, if you just copied the pointer, you would have weird things, right? And that's why we have a copy constructor. You want to allocate a new one because it's a new object. So this is where the creation of new things is happening. So as we allocate a new one, then we go pixel by pixel and copy it, right? Similarly, for the equal operator, we do exactly the same thing. So what we're going to do is go, in addition to having these regular copy constructor and assignment operator, have move constructors and move assignment operator. So let me copy this and paste it. And you'll see the compiler is not happy because now I have two of them, invalid redeclaration of the member function, right? So now this one is going to be an R value. And that one is going to be an R value as well. Now in the R value, we know basically the compiler is only going to call us here when it's creating these funny temporary things, right? So we know that we're safe in using it, in reusing the pointers, right? We can just throw away the old thing. So instead of creating a new pixel array and assigning it everything, I'm just going to say the new array equals the old array. Just use the exact same memory. And go to that old memory. Well, I'm going to use null pointer instead of null now, right? That old memory is null. Old memory is invalid. Old temporary object is gone. I don't care about it. I'm not going to delete it because I'm using the code. I'm using the array somewhere else, right? And I'm pointing to the old array. So my new temporary is now stealing the pixel array from the old temporary. And I'll do the same thing here. All right. Now if we build this, did I do something wrong? Yes, of course I'm doing something wrong. The operator takes a const, and now because I'm actually stealing bits from it, it doesn't need to be const, right? So we'll remove the const. Now as I build it and run that, I try to see if it's going to be any better performance. Selecting the same folder. Which picture did we use last time? Tulips. So use the same picture, making sure it's just the same size and everything. Grayscale. That was not my demo. It took 4 seconds. Let's do this a couple more times. So roughly in the 4 second range, right? 3 was an odd one out. Normally when I run it, it gets in the four second range, right? Went to 5.1. So about 5 seconds, say. So we went down from, 6.5 seconds on average to about 5 seconds on average, which is a good improvement, right? And I'm not saying this is all you're going to get. It's always going to get this, over 10%, maybe close to 20% improvement. It really depends on what you're doing. Your mileage will vary, If you were doing, for example, a blur operation as opposed to a grayscale operation, blur works on not just operating on your current pixel, but operating on a, 9 pixel by 9 pixel range, getting the average on all of them for color, right? So you're spending more time in your actual operation and less time copying. So because you're only optimizing the copy, you'll get less performance improvement if you had more CPU intensive thing. If you're doing a very trivial operation, like, concatenating a string, if you're doing that in a tight loop, concatenating a lot of strings, you'll get like some 60 or 70% improvements, right? So it really depends on what you're doing, but, this is a good practice, a good habit to do if you're writing performance-sensitive things. Since we have a little more time, I can actually give you a quick glimpse of the parallel code that we wrote, and I think I'll give you that because... this is really a funny sound, because we use lambdas in it heavily. Okay. So if you look here, when I'm downloading from the web for this application, as I download, it's taking a while, if I'm accessing the web, for example. So I want to put it on a background task. And traditionally, to put something on a background task, you had to go spin off threads, create your own loops for handling those and track its state and then know when to cancel and when to stop it. The parallel patterns library allow you to do something very simple, which is you create what is called a task group in the concurrency namespace. And I called it web tasks here. And you can just go say webtasks.run and you give it a function pointer, right? And in our case, instead of giving it a function pointer, I'm just giving it a lambda, right? So I gave it a new lambda. And I'm saying, do parallel for, which is another new construct that we have. Do all of these things, do this in parallel, do load image in parallel, right? And load image is yet another lambda, right? So I'm using two lambdas here. One that is inlined in the run function, that basically goes and runs this parallel for in the background. And the other one is a lambda that is passed to the parallel for. And that lambda does the loading of the image. Right? So I'm using two lambdas in this really, really small space. Lambdas are very, very useful. And I use auto to capture the return type of the lambda. Right? And web tasks, all I need to do then after that is do web task.wait, or it also allows me to do like a web task.cancel if I've pressed the cancel button or something like that. Right? So going back here, so I talked about the language improvements that we've made. And we have some library improvements as well. They're not as significant as language improvements, so I'll just mention them here out of completeness. The biggest and most important thing that we did was, we went and re-implemented R-value references throughout our library. In our standard template library, we went and used R-value references everywhere. So, for example, when we're doing like vector resizing or any places where we would create temporaries, we went and used R-value references. And the result for you there is that we have a faster STL, for example. We have a faster STL in 2010 than we had in 2008 because our value references allowed us to do that. We added some new things like, make shared pointer and unique pointer. Make shared allows you to do perfect forwarding as we talked for the forwarding problem. And unique pointer is a new auto pointer that is actually a better auto pointer. And I can talk to you about this one-on-one if you're interested. Similarly, we added, const iterators. We added more traits. So, for example, if you want to copy if or figure out if a certain container is sorted, we added these new things, and these are all part of the standard. Code conventions, system errors. I can talk to you about them after the session if you're interested. So, basically, in summary, these are the features that we added. C++ 0x is actually a very, very exciting and interesting release for the C++ standard. And in Visual Studio 2010, we made sure that we take the best out of C++ ZeroX and implement it so that you have it early on, even before the standard is actually ratified. So we're one of the first compilers out there that go and implement those features. And you know, one of the things that really made us happy was when Scott Myers mentioned on the news group you know, a week or two ago that he was very happy. And he's a very unbiased critic of compilers in general, and he's a very passionate person about C++, a very influential person about C++ as well. And he was saying, you know, that he's very happy with the set of features that we have implemented for C++ ZeroX in Visual C++ 10, and that he thinks that, you know, we're leading the pack in that space, which is a good thing. Again, I'm going to be here for the rest of the conference, and I'm going to be available outside in the Microsoft booth. There's a big expo area, and you know, I'm going to be there. Andy Rich from our team as well is here. And he's going to be with me in the booth. So see me or see Andy. We'll be happy to talk to you about anything in C++. I'm also going to be here after the talk if you want to talk and chat as well. A couple of resources I'll leave you with is our team blog. We provide a lot of information there. We explain the C++ ZeroX features to, you know, endless detail, bit by bit, to like, you know, n levels beyond what I've described today. Just to try to give you a quick tour of everything, but we go into a lot of detail in our blog about each feature and when to use it and how to use it and common gotchas. And also, our Developer Center has a lot of samples and good information. You know, that'll open up to questions if you have any questions. Shout it out because I can't see you if you have a question. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming. Really appreciate it. And I hope you enjoyed the session. Thanks.